Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is science and environmental writer Todd McLeish. And we're talking about his latest book, Return of the Sea Otter, the story of the animal that evaded extinction on the Pacific coast. Todd, welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Well, thank you so much.
This is a cool book because this is one of those things. First of all, even if you've never seen a live face-to-face sea otter, and I have many times, people are just enamored of them. But it's so much more of a complicated story as you bring out in this book. But how did you come to write about sea otters?
Well, I had one of those experiences, probably like you did, that was traveling in California a couple of decades ago and just didn't realize they were going to be so easy to see. And I stumbled across them, and they were close up. They were easy to observe. I got great pictures. And, of course, everyone knows they're adorable. And so that sort of got me interested in the first place. But when I was, trying to figure out what book to write about next, I have a book about narwhals and this new book, I was trying to figure out what animal would I be happy to spend 3 or 4 years of my life working on. What animal doesn't already have a book about it that, for an adult audience? And what animal has a built-in audience of fans already. And that's how we ended up with the sea otter.
I want to say they are the definition of cute unless you're a person that has to handle them.
Well, that is absolutely the case. And I started out the whole book, the introduction, in fact, with a story about a guy who is trying to raise them in captivity at an aquarium in Monterey Bay, California. And he's the one who says, yeah, they're not cute, because he's had so many nasty encounters with them as their, up close and personal accounts with scratches and bites and so forth. So they are indeed cute and adorable from a distance, but get them in a trap, which I did with one of my adventures working with them, or, get them in your hands for one reason or another, and they're tough.
I want to mention they're tough on each other, too, because mating sea otters can be really tough on females.
Yeah, that is one of those stories that you don't hear too often because everybody knows and thinks that they're adorable. But yes, it's not a romantic encounter by any means. In fact, you can even identify the difference between males and females because the females all have scars on their noses. Essentially, the mating ritual involves the male biting the female's nose to hold her down. And sometimes that involves, really tearing into that nose, ripping it off. Females have died from infections in their nose as a result of that. So yes, it's a nasty experience that those promoting sea otter don't necessarily want to tell about.
Well, let's get some of the basics of sea otters down first. For people here in the East who may be familiar with river otters, and they're in the same family, they're mustelids.
Right.
How do they compare in size?
So river otters are maybe a third smaller. So and
river otters are big. So
they are. I think most people see cute pictures and videos and don't realize how large either of the animals are. Right. A sea otter can grow to almost 5 feet long and maybe 100 pounds. That's a lot bigger than most people imagine. And a river otter might be 30 pounds, might be 3 or 4 feet long at their longest. So certainly there's that difference just in size. But then it's kind of easy when you see them in action to distinguish them, even from a distance. So river otters always swim on their bellies, whereas sea otters always swim on their backs. River otters give birth to 3 or 4 pups at a time. Sea otters just one. River otters are in freshwater and on land, probably 50-50 split, whereas sea otters are exclusively in salt water and spend almost their entire life in that water. Very seldom do they come on land.
And whenever I see a sea otter, the fur looks totally different than when I see a river otter.
It does. And in fact, I like to describe it because when I show some pictures of both animals to people, the river otter looks kind of sleek.
Right.
Like he's freshly groomed. He's pulled his hair back. He's sleek and ready to go. And the sea otter, as adorable as he is, looks kind of rumpled and scruffy looking with his kind of crazy wild hair.
Now, the other thing which is fascinating, and I've actually seen this face-to-face too, is they are a tool user.
They are, absolutely. And not many tool users out there, but these guys certainly do it really interestingly. So they feed primarily on shellfish, whether it's sea urchins or clams or crabs or abalone, whatever it is that they want to eat. They mostly have shells. And so otters will bring up go down to the bottom, find these creatures in the seafloor, bring them up to the surface, put that item basically on their chest while they're on their back, almost like their chest is a picnic table, and then use a rock to crack open that shelled item, and they will even have a favorite rock that they will store in a little sort of a flap in their skin in their armpit. So they can then dive down to the bottom, find another thing, bring it to the surface, and pull out that tool out of their armpit and crack it open again.
You even relate in the book, there's somebody observed an otter using, a piece of a jar or something to specifically open chitons or something like that. I can't remember, but it was literally something that was perfect for that otter to open this prey item.
I think that's the case. Certainly there are anecdotal stories of that kind of thing happening. You have they have a particular tool for a particular prey item. And so, yes, a jar or a glass bottle or something might be the best tool for one kind of creature. A rock that they find someplace might be the best tool for another creature. And I remember when I was out there in California one day, hearing this loud pounding noise and in an area where there were a lot of sea otters. And it was an otter slamming a crab against the hull of a boat.
Wow!
So, yes, they will use whatever they have available to open up that shellfish.
What's their natural range today?
It's kind of broken up. They're in central California, just north of L.A. to just south of San Francisco. And then there's a break. They're not in Northern California. They're not in Oregon. And then they go from Washington all the way up to southeast Alaska, out the Aleutian Islands of Alaska all the way to Russia. Essentially, that's where they are today.
Now, the thing I love about your books, Todd, always is you're always the person on the scene. You don't just write about these things. You actually go to the places where things are happening, and we'll talk about some of those as we go along today. But you must love that. I mean, you get to talk to all these different people, these researchers. You're always there out in the boat or doing whatever they're doing and actually conversing with the people involved in these stories.
Well, and that's why I do it. That's why I write these books, because it gives me an opportunity to go on these cool adventures. And I've had lots of cool adventures. With my narwhal book, I was in the northern tip of Greenland and in a 3-week research camp out there. With this one, I had 5 or 6 really exciting adventures up and down the Alaska shoreline in Washington and California. And again, it's for me, it's the reason I do it, so that I can go and have some fun adventures and come home and tell some stories. But it's also important to be able to keep those kind of fun adventures in the book to keep people's attention while I'm feeding them some hardcore science at the same time.
That's right. And also, by doing that, there's a lot of color commentary that you can add because you were there. You can talk about different things and give it the reporting depth. So I just want to say that on behalf. This is not a dry science book at all. This is a really fascinating and fun, interesting book.
In fact, when I'm on those field trips, I always have a notebook in my back pocket, and whenever somebody, one of the scientists, says something funny or bizarre or something that's clearly quotable, I pull out my notebook, and they always laugh and say, "Oh no, I shouldn't have said that out loud." So yes, there's lots of fun quotes and fun stories that the scientists are telling, and that I then get to retell because I'm there in first person, hearing the stories, watching the adventures unfold.
One of the most important things about sea otters that it becomes very clear early on in your book is that they're a keystone species in at least 2 different ecosystems, that they exert, and this is your own words, a dramatic positive influence on 2 completely different ecosystems.
It's true, and maybe people haven't heard the term keystone species before, but they they probably get it. And the concept is that here's an animal that plays this enormous role in maintaining the health of their ecosystem. In most places, you know, there's, you know, if you remove one species from an ecosystem, most, for the most part, that ecosystem is going to continue to operate as normal until you start removing, you know, a number of other species. But in the case of the kelp forest where sea otters live, the otters exert this enormous influence. You remove, well, a normal, healthy kelp forest with a sea otter, with a sea otter population in it, is this lush, wonderful habitat with, you know, kelp growing 100 feet from the seafloor up to the surface, with lots of fish and seals swimming around, with all sorts of wonderful marine invertebrates on the seafloor. It's a spectacularly lush habitat. But if you remove those otters from that habitat, it changes dramatically, and basically everything disappears. Because what happens is that the otters, one of their favorite foods is sea urchins. If you remove the otters, the urchin numbers grow. The urchin's favorite food is kelp. They eat all the kelp, and all the rest of the species disappear. If you then return the otters to that same place, they start eating the urchins, the kelp regrows, and all the other species return. It really is a remarkable influence when you add in an otter or you take out an otter from this particular habitat.
One of the things you did in the book is you actually dove in and among one of these kelp forests, which I've always wanted to do. Talk to me what that was like. Because, you know, I've gone snorkeling in the Caribbean and off the coast of Massachusetts. But, you know, I've seen film of these kelp forests, and it looks eerie. It looks sort of very strange and different from anything else I've experienced.
It is eerie. And in part for me, it was eerie because it was my very first time ever scuba diving.
Whoops.
So I had gotten trained in diving here in Rhode Island maybe 8 years prior to this dive, and I never got to go diving after that. And then when I had this opportunity, I jumped at it and, well, then was really nervous. And so it was a little bit nervous for me, but once I got down there, and it really was spectacular. You know, all this kelp, even though you're in relatively shallow water and the sunlight can penetrate, all this kelp really kind of shades the water and makes it kind of eerie as you're swimming in and out of the illuminated part of the water and into the shaded parts of the water. You got to be careful you're not going to get entangled because, again, this kelp is 100 feet tall. It's you know, grows thickly in this kelp forest environment, and so you've got to be careful you're not going to get entangled in it. And yet, wow, the animals that are there are just spectacular. And the things that really got me excited were things like nudibranches.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
These sea slugs that are bright pink and bright green and bright purple and not giant things, but still stunning creatures, and all sorts of other things that were
sea hares.
Just amazing.
You got to see sea hares.
Yes, sea hares, and their eggs that look like a big plate of spaghetti. Yes, and then, you know, all sorts of fish and clams, and then you go up through the middle of the water column where the kelp is, and you've got different layers of water. At different depths, you get different species that are there, different kinds of fish, other kinds of invertebrates. It really is a stunning place to be, and all the kelp forests are, you know, you basically are walking right in the water from the shore. So it's not like you got to go out in a boat a few miles. You walk in from the beach.
Wow. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is science and environmental writer Todd McLeish. And we're talking about his latest book. It is a great read, perfect for the summer, Return of the Sea Otter, the story of the animal that evaded extinction on the Pacific coast. And let's talk about that. What was the main cause of the original dissemination of sea otters on the Pacific coast?
Well, so this is a species that has the most remarkable fur coat of any animal on Earth. It's got a million hairs per square inch. So this fur coat is wonderful for it. It doesn't need blubber to stay warm, even though it lives in the cold Pacific year-round. And yet, people, of course, eventually discovered that this makes a wonderful fur coat for us as well. And so as early as the late 1700s, when there was a big demand in China, especially for furs, there were Russian traders, and then eventually there were American and British traders that were either hunting otters or trading with the natives along the Pacific coast of North America for sea otter furs, and then selling those furs to the merchants in China. Unfortunately, over the course of about 50 years, until the mid-1800s, we went from a worldwide population of about 250,000 sea otters down to 1,000 otters.
Wow.
And so that's the big decline that happened. And ever since then, they've been recovering, and that's essentially the story where I get this title, The Return of the Sea Otter. We start with this big decline as a result of the fur trade, and then they've been recovering slowly in different parts of their range ever since then.
Now, people listening to this are probably thinking, well, everybody's really happy that the sea otter is back to, or at least trying to get back to the original numbers, and that is not true. You went up to Alaska, and there are people there who just to see shoot them, didn't look at them.
Yeah, well, that is indeed the case, certainly plenty of fishermen and even native tribal folks along the Alaska coastline as well. And the large part is that sea otters are voracious eaters. They have to eat 30% of their weight every single day to maintain their body weight, to maintain their warmth. And so...
They have no blubber.
They have no blubber, correct. They have a high metabolism, so they've literally got to eat, you know, an awful lot of food every day. Back before there were commercial fisheries, that was fine. They were able to keep up with, they were able to eat what they needed and without wiping out the prey species. But when otters were basically gone for 100 years after the fur trade, humans created commercial fisheries for crabs, for clams, for sea cucumbers, for sea urchins, and those were going great guns and doing just fine for the fishermen until the sea otters began to return. The sea otters are much better fishermen than the fishermen are, and so basically, when the sea otters returned, they were out competing the fishermen for their catch. And it only takes 10 or 15 years for the otters to basically make a sea urchin fishery unviable any longer. And a little longer than that to make a sea cucumber fishery unviable. So the fishermen clearly are not happy at all, especially those in Southeast Alaska, but in other places in California and elsewhere in their range as well. They recognize that they're a popular animal, that they're a cute little thing that everybody adores, but for them, it really is having an economic impact.
But what I got out of reading your book is these fisheries for things like sea urchins, they were based on an ecosystem that was essentially out of whack.
Well, correct, yes. So what happened was that the otters were gone, and all these urchins and clams and crabs and abalone numbers skyrocketed because they didn't have this voracious eater to keep those populations under control. Those populations skyrocketed, and all of a sudden along comes little old man who says, ooh, there's so many of them here, let's start developing these commercial fisheries. So yes, they were at an unnatural level before, after the fur trade, and so now we have people whose only memory is of an unnatural level of these species. Now the otters are coming back, and the shellfish are going back to their more natural levels. The fishermen, of course, are unhappy.
In the case of the abalone fishery, were the sea otters really the main cause of the depletion of the abalone?
That doesn't seem to be the case, and so there's 6 or 7 or 8 different kinds of abalone up and down the Pacific coast, and some of them were depleted by fishermen long before the otters even returned and grew in numbers again, and some of them were depleted in areas where otters still are not found, and yet of course the fishermen are still blaming the otters. So clearly there's many things going on. Yes, the otters do eat a lot and do wipe out some commercial fisheries, but in other cases the fishermen are doing it to themselves, which we know is the case in other fisheries around the world as well at times.
There's always these plans, and you write about them in the book, of creating like otter-free zones. How is that ever going to be successful with a creature that's aquatic that you're not going to be able to fence in the ocean and prevent them from going there?
Yeah, that, and that's exactly what well, not exactly a fence, but certainly that concept was one that the fishermen were advocating as far back as the 60s when they realized that the otters were returning and they could put their businesses in jeopardy. So what the plan was and what the California government agreed to try to do was to try to find a location where there weren't fisheries and move some of the otters there, so that the fishermen could continue their fishing without having to compete with the otters. Well, of course, the otters sort of have a preferred home range. They know where they came from. You drop them off someplace 200 miles away, and they're eventually going to try to find their way back, and that just doesn't work. And in fact, this battle has been going on in the courts for years and years. The Fish and Wildlife Service eventually said this isn't working. We're not going to try to keep relocating these otters back to these out of these no otter zones. And the fishermen are still fighting that. But it seems pretty clear that you can't keep an otter up in a place that it doesn't want to be, because they've got a wonderful ability to swim and they know where they prefer to be.
You have a great section on things that cause otter mortality. And it's fascinating. A lot of otters are taken by great whites.
Well, you know, one of the things that really got me fascinated, and I had no idea before I started this project, was that there's a different storyline about otters in almost every part of their range. And so in California, yes, the leading cause of death of sea otters in California is great white sharks. And that's essentially denying them the opportunity to expand their range. That's why they're only in this small central California coast range, because if they try to expand their range northward or southward, that's where there are some seal rookeries where great white sharks are in abundance eating the seals, and oh, there's a sea otter. Let's take a bite out of that guy.
No, well, yeah, stop right there, because the sad thing is they're not actually eating the sea otters.
Yes, exactly correct. They take a bite, they realize this is a big fur ball, and they spit it out. Unfortunately, it kills the otter, and it doesn't even provide any nutrition for the shark. So that's the storyline in California. In the Aleutian Islands of Alaska, that long island chain that goes all the way across the North Pacific to Russia, the issue is not sharks, but it's killer whales. And they, at least some of them, seem to have shifted their diets from seals to sea otters. And as a result, over the course of about a 20-year period, the Aleutian Island otter population went from about 100,000 down to maybe 5,000 or 6,000.
Wow.
And so, you know, we got basically two endangered species that are doing this naturally, and we can't do anything about it. We got to let nature take its course. Hopefully, in that case, the otter numbers will get small enough that the killer whales will decide to switch back to seals and allow the otters to return. So interesting, two different predators, two different parts of the world, part of their range, and they're having these dramatic effects on the species.
And there's a lot of other things that are causing woes for the sea otters. One of the scariest things is, I think it's toxoplasmosis that they're getting from kitty litter.
Yeah, that's the bizarre thing. So if you're a sea otter in California and you're not dying from a shark bite, you're probably dying from this thing called toxoplasmosis, which comes from some bacterium, I believe, in the feces of cats. Now, how does it get into a sea otter in the water? Well, that's sort of a strange question, or a good question. But essentially, somehow this bacterium sloughs off of the interior of the intestine in the feces, gets into the kitty litter. We dispose of the kitty litter. Somehow it gets into the stream or whatever that feeds into the water. The shellfish absorb that bacterium, and then the otters eat the shellfish. And so, yes, they are dying from a kitty feces disease, strangely enough. In fact, if you were trying to buy a box of kitty litter in California right now, it would have a special label on it about how to properly dispose of it to protect sea otters.
That's amazing. There's so much cool stuff in this book about sea otters, too. Just one more thing before we're almost out of time. When you talk about how they're finding food in deep water, they're actually able to change the shape of their eye?
Yes. Yes. Again, so they have a remarkable set of senses, and their eyesight is one that's particularly notable because, as we all know, when humans are in the air, we can see through the air just fine. But when we go underwater and open our eyes, we see very blurry.
Right.
And that's the case with most animals. They're either adapted to see underwater or see above water. But in the case of sea otters, they're able to use some muscles around their eye to change the shape of their eye lens. And it's the shape of the eye lens that determines whether you can see well in the air or in the water. And so, yes, you just imagine, you know, we try to squint really hard and all of a sudden something comes clear for us. Well, that's sort of what they're doing underwater. They squint a bit or they do something with their eye muscles and change the shape of that eye lens, and that allows them to see just as clear underwater as in the air.
We're almost out of time. What's your personal favorite place to see sea otters?
Well, the easiest place to see otters is Monterey Bay, California.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
If you go to Monterey, you know, you walk down that road that John Steinbeck made famous, Cannery Row. That's where there's lots of shops. That's where the aquarium is. And you basically go to the back door of all those shops, the back door of the aquarium, and there are otters right below you in the water. They're easy to see. And you can go scuba diving with them. That's where I went diving. And that's the most densely populated stretch of coastline for sea otters. You'll find more sea otters there in, you know, a 10-mile stretch than any place else in the world. So if you want to see them, it's a beautiful town to visit anyway.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, sea otters, because they're so popular, they're sort of driving the economy in Monterey. Certainly that's the place to go, and I encourage everyone to do so, just because that's an easy place to get a close-up look
and
at
pick
an
up,
otter.
And pick up your sea otter T-shirts while you're there.
Exactly, yes.
My returning guest tonight has been science and environmental writer Todd McLeish. We always enjoy having him on the show, and we're talking about his latest book. It's a great read, Return of the Sea Otter, the story of the animal that evaded extinction on the Pacific coast. Todd, it's a pleasure as always.
Glad to be here, Mark. Thanks so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.